The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
He is our ambassador of the Great American Songbook. He's a multi-platinum record producer, maker, artist, seller, multi-Emmy and Grammy nominations. He's dedicated his life to restoring America's grandest popular soundtrack through books, broadcasting, and his Michael Feinstein Great American Songbook Initiative. He also belts it out at more than 200 shows a year, from Carnegie Hall to the Sydney Opera House, from the White House to Buckingham Palace, and here at the Montgomery Auditorium at the Free Library of Philadelphia. His new book is called The Gershwins and Me. It illuminates the lives of Ira and George Gershwin through the stories behind their music, which I bet do not include making a fool of himself on the elevator of the Portman Hotel. It is such a treat to have him grace this storied stage. So please give Michael Feinstein the fabulous Philadelphia welcome he deserves.
Don't mind telling you, in my humble fashion, that you thrill me through with a tender passion. When you said you care, imagine my emotion. I swore then and there, permanent devotion. There really is a Santa Claus. My dear, I'm sure there is, because it's wonderful, it's marvelous. You should care for me. It's awful nice, it's paradise. It's what I love to see. You've made my life so glamorous. You can't blame me for feeling amorous. Oh, it's wonderful, it's marvelous that you should care for me. It's wonderful, it's marvelous, you should care for me. It's elegant, it's what I want, it's what I need to see. But oh, what's all this dizziness? I thought that I came here on business. It's wonderful, it's marvelous that you should care for me. My dear, I feel so tinglish. I'll even overlook your English. Success. Exceptional, no bagatelle that you should care for me. That you should care.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. How often do any of us have a moment in our lives that we recognize as a life-changing experience, that is going to change the trajectory of our destiny? I had that experience in July of 1977 when I got to meet Ira Gershwin. I was 20 years old and he was 80, and I knew that that moment would change my life in ways that I couldn't possibly predict but knew was significant. Now, I had been obsessed with the work of the Gershwins from the time I was very, very young, and people have often asked me, why? How is it that I came to have this interest in the Gershwins? And it is a story that I did want to tell in the context of the greater important careers of these two geniuses who changed the face of American music. I will tell you briefly how that happened, but I just want to say that the Gershwin name, the legacy of the Gershwins is extraordinary. You probably already agree with that or feel that because you're here and you're not someplace else. But the name Gershwin certainly is well known to many, many people. Yet we are in a time when generations are changing, and there isn't as much of an awareness as there once was of the Gershwins. I have a friend who is a voice teacher, and one of her students stood up one day and said, "I'm going to sing Summertime by Porgy and Bess." So I thought maybe I should really think about writing that Gershwin book after that. It really got me to thinking about that. The work of the Gershwins is so much a part of the fabric of our culture, not only the music but the lyrics that Ira Gershwin wrote that were making use of the vernacular language of the time that still is popular. I am reminded of a story about the two great comedy writers, Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks, who were working together in the 1950s on a television show. Carl wasn't feeling so well, and he went to the doctor. When he returned, Mel said, "What did the doctor say?" Carl said, "The doctor said, I've got arrhythmia." And without missing a beat, Mel said, "Who could ask for anything more?" Now, I came to discover the music of the Gershwins by watching television shows and movies. I saw the movie Rhapsody in Blue when I was a kid. My parents used to allow me to stay up late to watch the old movies on television because the old musical films were considered filler. They weren't considered significant. It was long before we had something like TCM where these movies were given their proper due. And these films were always on late at night, and they would let me stay up late because they knew how important it was to me. And I saw this film about the life of George Gershwin that I later found out was all but fictitious. But it did have the authenticity of the participation of many of Gershwin's associates and friends and great performances of the music. I started playing the piano when I was 5 years old. It was an experience that was not only shocking to me but to my parents because they had purchased a piano. They didn't have enough money in this new home that they'd recently acquired to buy furniture and a piano, but my father prevailed and they bought a piano. I'm the youngest of three kids, and they thought for some reason that one of us might play the piano. I sat down at that piano and started playing Do, Re, Mi from The Sound of Music with both hands by ear, and my mother came out of the kitchen into the empty living room and said, "Who taught you that?" I said, "Nobody." She said, "Well, somebody had to teach you that." I said, "Nobody taught me that." She said, "Well, you couldn't have made it up." I said, "I did. I figured it out on my own." She sent me to my room for lying. And ever since then, I've always connected pain and punishment with music. But I'll get over it one day, or maybe not. But in any event, I started playing the piano, and for some reason, I was attracted to the classic songs. It was the music that still was quite prevalent on television, of course, with variety shows like Carol Burnett, and shows like Sing Along with Mitch, and Lawrence Welk, who was as square as could be, but introduced a lot of people to this music. I was quite fascinated by Lawrence Welk when I was a kid because he would clearly say things that were malaprops and mistakes on the air, and nobody seemed to notice. One time, he was reading cue cards, often reading cue cards. He said, "And now the Duke Ellington classic, Take a Train." That was Lawrence Welk. It's true. It's not a joke. Another time, reading cue cards, he said, "Now a medley of songs from World War I. Lawrence Welk. And one time, he was introducing his progeny, his grandson. He said, "I'd like you to meet my grandson, Lawrence Welk the III. That was... Yes. I am digressing. I apologize. In any event, by the time I was in my teens, I was playing the piano by ear and had become firmly and thoroughly entrenched with the Gershwin music and had fallen in love with it. The first thing I discovered really was Rhapsody in Blue, which was life-changing for me, and it was for George Gershwin's career as well when he created Rhapsody in Blue at the age of 25. And it was something he wrote in 3.5 weeks, and I'll get to that. But by the time I was 20, I had moved to L.A. from my hometown of Columbus, Ohio. Hold the applause. And I had known that Ira Gershwin was alive, but I didn't ever dream that I would meet him. But through a series of odd permutations, I met the widow of Oscar Levant, June Levant. Oscar Levant was a great concert pianist who was the greatest interpreter of George Gershwin's music. And at the time of George Gershwin's death in 1937, Gershwin music was considered too vulgar to be part of the concert hall. It seems odd to think of that now. But in those days, when Oscar Levant wanted to perform the Gershwin Concerto in F or Rhapsody in Blue in a concert hall, there was resistance because it was not in the same league as Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms. And so he single-handedly helped to popularize the Gershwin concert music in a way that is quite extraordinary. He was originally from Pittsburgh, but he was also famous for the quips that he made about people. He had an extraordinary wit. He said that he knew Doris Day before she became a virgin. When Eddie Fisher left Debbie Reynolds to marry Elizabeth Taylor, Oscar said, "How high could anyone stoop?" And he was very close friends with George Gershwin, and George Gershwin had a very healthy ego and no false modesty. So at one point, Oscar said, "Tell me, George, if you had your life to live all over again, would you fall in love with yourself again?" That was Oscar Levant. But Mrs. Levant introduced me to the Gershwins, and the day that I met Ira and his wife Leonore, it was quite extraordinary because I knew a lot about his songs. It's almost as if I was being subconsciously prepared for the moment that I would meet Ira. It was quite amazing to me. And when the front door opened and I walked in and saw Mr. Gershwin sitting at a table, my knees began to quake because I'd only seen photos of him, and to think that I was in the presence of this man was extraordinary to me. I greeted him. He invited me to sit down. And Leonore and her sister were sitting in a corner observing all of this. And he was autographing a record album. And I said, "Mr. Gershwin, I have that album." It was an album made of home recordings and demos of Ira singing his own work. And he was no Caruso. And he was shocked that I had this album. He said, "You're the first person I've met outside of a relative who has this album." He said, "Why do you have it?" I said, "Because I love your work." And then there was a moment of silence, and to make conversation, I said, "You know, Mr. Gershwin, I have a 78 of Gems from La La Lucille." That was George Gershwin's first Broadway show, 1919. And Ira said, "Oh, well, that must contain the two most significant songs from the score, Nobody But You and Teotihuacan." And I said, "That's right." And Lee Gershwin turned to her sister and said, "Isn't that cute? He's telling Ira that's right." So I was hired to catalog Ira's collection of phonograph records. And so suddenly there I was every day spending time with Ira. And he knew that I was interested in his work, but he didn't realize how much until something happened about a month after I had been there. I would take these phonograph records and catalog them. He wanted them thoroughly cataloged in every which way possible, long before computers made it easy to do so. And as I would play these records, I would sometimes whistle things between the sides that I would play. And Ira was always sitting close by. And one day I was whistling something, and he was reading the New York Times, and he froze, and he turned around, and he said, "Mike," he said, "that's the verse of Beginner's Luck. I wrote that with George in 1936 for Shall We Dance?" And I said, "I know." He said, "How do you know that?" I said, "Because I told you I know a lot about your work." And he started quizzing me to see how much I knew. And he was sort of taken aback by all of that because he didn't realize how thoroughly I was entrenched in his work because I was 20 years old. He was 80 years old, you know, 60-year difference. So he became more and more curious about my background and who I was and how I had this interest. And at one point, he looked at me and he said, "How many more like you are there?" because it was so unusual for someone to be so interested at my age. And the great gift for me was that Ira was my college education. I never had any proper education in music. I got out of high school and started playing in piano bars with the full approval of my parents, because they knew that that's where my heart was, that I had to be performing music. And so they just knew that if they let me loose, I would hopefully find my way. So Ira became my mentor. He became someone who taught me most of what I know about interpreting these classic songs, and for that I'll always be extraordinarily grateful to him. It got to a point in my relationship with him that sometimes he would start to tell me a story and I would correct him. Sometimes he didn't have the story quite right or whatever, and one time he was telling me something and he said, well, that was 1931, and I said, no, it was 1930. He said, no, I remember, because such and such. I said, no, it was 1930, and I got some reference book and I showed him. He said, well, you have an advantage over me. And I said, what is that? He said, I've only lived my life, but you've thoroughly researched it. People have often asked about the collaborative process of the Gershwin brothers. It's quite interesting because George Gershwin was born September 26, 1898 in Brooklyn at 242 Snedeker Avenue, for any of you who care about such things. And Ira was born 18 months earlier in Manhattan in 1896, and they were two halves of a whole. It's fascinating to me that there was a genius at writing lyrics and a genius at composing music, and they were related. Ira was the first person to discover George's talent, and he felt from a very early age that George would become world famous, and indeed he became the most famous American musician in the world. And when they started collaborating, they almost had an innate or a psychic connection in the way that they worked together. And I'd like to give you an example of that. One day, they were working, George and I were working on on the movie Shall We Dance, and they had to come up with the big ballad for the film. It was to be performed by Fred Astaire. And George came up with a melody that Ira liked, and it went like this. It's not like that. Ira said, I like the melody, George. He said, but it's a bit of a problem. And George said, what is the problem? He said, well, you know, it's four notes. Da-da-da-dee, da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da. Doesn't give a lyricist much room to express something. I love you so, you are my heart. Four syllables, not a lot. And it's da-da-da-dee, da-da-da-da, da-da-da-dee, da-da-da-da. And so he said, if you can give me some more notes. He said, I have an idea for something. So George thought, and he came up with. It gave Ira just what he needed, and together they created this. The way you wear your hat, the way you sip your tea, the memory of all that. Oh no, they can't take that away from me. The way your smile just beams, the way you sing off key, the way you haunt my dreams. Oh no, they can't take that away from me. We may never, never meet again on the bumpy road to love, but I'll always, always keep the memory of the way you hold your knife, the way we dance till three, the way you've changed my life. No, no, they can't take that away from me, no. They can't take that away. Can't take that away. Can't take that away from me. give you another example of how funny things can happen in the moment of creation. George and I were working on a show in 1926 called OK, starred Gertrude Lawrence, a great musical theater star of the time. And again, they were trying to come up with several different songs that were needed for the show. One of the things that they needed was a big, fast-paced dance number. And George Gershwin was known as being the king of coming up with different interesting rhythmic ideas for songs. And he came up with an idea that he thought was rather good for the dance sequence. And the idea of that song was... It was syncopated. Well, as he was playing it, he was distracted, and as he was distracted, he started to slow down. And as he slowed down, Ira said, "George, play it slow." And he played. They realized that they had found the tune for the ballad that they needed. Ira went to work on the lyric, and he wrote this song just around the time he married his wife, Leonore. And it was an unusual relationship in that Ira was so shy and felt that he was so undesirable to women that he didn't have the nerve to ask Lee for her hand in marriage. So finally, she got tired of waiting, and she proposed to him. Well, Ira felt so lucky to win a woman like Lee that he confessed that for one of the few times in his career, he put a line in the song that was autobiographical, because usually he was just writing for character. He had to write for different plot situations, but he did confess to me that he wrote one line about himself. "He may not be the man some girls think of as handsome." So I'd like to dedicate this to Ira and Lee, who were married for over 50 years. Not happily, but they were together. There's a saying old says that love is blind. Still we're often told, seek and ye shall find. So I'm going to seek a certain girl I've had in mind. Looking everywhere, haven't found her yet. She's the big affair I cannot forget. Only girl I ever think of with regret. I'd like to add my initial to her monogram. Tell me, where is the shepherd for this lost lamb? There's a somebody I'm longing to see. I hope that she turns out to be someone who'll watch over me. I'm a little lamb that's lost in the wood. I know I could always be good to one who'll watch over me. Although I may not be the man some girls think of as handsome, to her heart I'll carry the key. Won't you tell her please to put on some speed? Follow my lead, oh. Someone to watch over me. She may be far, she may be nearby. I'm promising hereby, to my heart she'll carry the key. And this world would be like heaven if she follow my lead, oh, how I
cover me. Someone to watch.
To the Gershwins and Cole Porter. So the journey of George Gershwin is an extraordinary one. In the book, The Gershwins and Me, I try to give a real sense of what both these guys were like and give a sense of the era. The book is divided into 12 chapters that each have a song title that is the springboard for anecdotes and stories and particular moments in their lives, trying to set down and preserve all the stories that Ira told me and his associates. There's so much marginalia about the Gershwins that hadn't been collected or preserved, so that's what I attempted to do, and it's filled with lots of photographs and memorabilia that illustrate. And it also has a CD in it, in the back, so it's got the recordings, new recordings of the 12 songs, so it was fun to do. But the thing that's amazing about George Gershwin is that the energy of what he wrote in the 1920s still has a certain kind of currency that touches people in the same energetic way. George Gershwin was a product of New York, of the melting pot of New York City. He was the son of Russian Jewish immigrants, as were many of these songwriters, and he was affected by all the sounds and sights of New York in a way that literally went into the DNA of his music. Rhapsody in Blue is something that he conceived on the way back from Philadelphia to New York while working on a show called Sweet Little Devil, and he said it was the noises of the train and the sound of the city that inspired him to write that piece. Incidentally, or not incidentally, many, many Gershwin shows first had their tryouts here in Philadelphia, as many of you may know. For example, the show Lady Be Good had its tryout here in 1924, and this was the only place that the song The Man I Love was heard on stage, because it was cut from Lady Be Good just 2 days into its preview. So it was sung here by Adele Astaire in 1924, and then was an obscure and forgotten song until it started to become popular on its own almost 6 years later. But it was premiered and heard for the first time on any stage here in Philadelphia. Philadelphia was a lucky city for the Gershwin brothers, and that many of their shows that tried out here had great success later, and they always loved coming here. The thing I want to tell you most about George Gershwin that I think is misconstrued about him is concerning his ego. He had a very healthy ego, but he had no false modesty. And the thing about him is that he loved other composers' works and other songwriters and was greatly supportive of them. But if you were to say, George, I love Porgy and Bess, I think it's genius, he would say, thank you, I do too. And that's because he knew that what he wrote channeled through him in a way that it was great. And it was so great that even he would look at it and say, this is great. And he didn't have any false, oh shucks kind of feelings about it. He was not afraid to express that. And everybody wanted George Gershwin to play the piano at their parties because he was the most extraordinary pianist. And once he sat down at the piano, he would play for hours, and nobody wanted him to get up from the piano unless there was another songwriter there who was kind of envious. One time he was at a party, and other attendees were Rachmaninoff and Vladimir Horowitz. And Rachmaninoff got really angry and finally pulled Gershwin off the keyboard and said, let Horowitz play the piano! So that happened. But George Gershwin was this guy who wrote Tin Pan Alley songs, and then Paul Whiteman, who was a great band leader in the 1920s, decided that he was going to give a concert in a concert hall of a dance band that was going to prove that jazz was a legitimate form of American music, because jazz was much maligned and considered the devil's music. And so he announced that George Gershwin was going to be writing a special piece for this concert. George Gershwin picks up a newspaper and reads this and calls Paul Whiteman and says, what the hell are you talking about? And Whiteman said, well, we talked about you doing something one day, and he said, yes, but this, he said, well, would you try? And George said, I'll try. So in a period of 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks, George very hurriedly composed Rhapsody in Blue. It was special material just for the Paul Whiteman Band. He was just trying to meet the deadline and get it done in time. And when it was premiered February 12, 1924, it was pandemonium. It was one of the last pieces on a very long program. And people were galvanized immediately by Rhapsody in Blue. The critics were divided in their affection for it, but clearly the audience loved it. And it was repeated 12 times over the next several months. And 3 weeks after its composition, after its premiere, rather, it was published. And George went to Ira and said, our publisher, Max Dreyfuss, is going to publish Rhapsody in Blue. And Ira said, he's crazy. For God's sake, who's going to buy it? I mean, the point is that Rhapsody in Blue was a 15-minute piece for piano and orchestra. Who was going to buy it? But within 2 years, it was the most famous piece of American music in the world. And on the strength of Rhapsody in Blue, George Gershwin was then asked to write a piano concerto for the New York Philharmonic. He agreed, signed the contract, then went out and bought a book to read what a concerto is. He aced that as well. Then he went on to write An American in Paris, and then his greatest masterwork, Porgy and Bess. Porgy and Bess was met with, again, mixed emotions on every level. All the songwriters told George that he was not capable of writing an opera. The African-American community was certainly offended that this white Jewish man felt that he could express their voice. The Metropolitan Opera had no interest in producing it because they did not want to hire an all-black cast. But George Gershwin put his life on hold for 2 years to write Porgy and Bess, stop concertizing, stop doing everything but work on Porgy because he was clear about what he wanted to accomplish. When it premiered October of 1935, it was not well received. It was a complete financial failure. It closed a few months later. It was a complete financial loss in a way that George was shocked by. At the time, though, even though there was devastation at its failure, he also said, one day people will recognize Porgy and Bess for its quality. And he predicted it would become a beloved opera. Again, he was absolutely right. It is the opera by which all other American operas are compared. So that is really something. Well, Ira, in all those years, was so opposite of George. If George was at a party, you would know it because he'd be at the piano. If Ira was at a party, he would be very much in the background and you wouldn't know he was there because he was very shy and quiet. He was not a guy who liked attention. And he had a very funny and delightful sense of humor. One day when he was sitting at the dinner table, I said, how do you feel, Mr. Gershwin? He said, not so good. I'm a Rhapsody in Bruise. Another time he was at dinner and he had this plate of beets and he started to put one on his own plate and went all over his shirt. And he said, oh, that's terrible. I said, it's not such a terrible thing. He said, no, it's a terrible thing when a songwriter loses a beat. I would like to tell you Ira's favorite story, or favorite joke based on a Gershwin song. A lady goes into an audition and she gets up on stage and sings, you say either and I say either, you say neither and I say neither, either, either, neither, neither, let's call the whole thing off. The director says, thank you very much, Mrs. Levine. And she says, the name's Levine. So one day I'm giving a concert. It was a special evening with a lot of different wonderful people on the bill, and Shirley MacLaine was the host. And Shirley MacLaine introduced me by saying, Michael Feinstein is a protege of George and Ira Bernstein. I came on stage and said, Shirley, it's Bernstein. I'm going to play for you a song that is the first hit song that the Gershwins wrote together. George Gershwin had a hit with Swanee when he was 20 years old, and that was the biggest hit of his career. But it wasn't until a few years later that he started to write regularly with Ira, and they wrote a song for the George White Scandals that was something they considered too sophisticated to be a hit. But it turned out to be a huge hit of 1922, and it went like this. All you preachers who delight in panning the dancing teachers, let me tell you there are a lot of features of the steps to carry you through the gates of heaven. It's madness to be always sitting around in sadness when you could be learning the steps of gladness. You'll be happy when you can do just 6 or 7. Begin today, you'll find it nice, the quickest way to paradise. When you practice, here's the thing to do: simply say as you go, I'll build a stairway to paradise with a new step every day. I'm going to get there at any price. Stand aside, I'm on my way. I got the blues, and up above it's no fair shoes. Come on and carry me there. I'll build a stairway to paradise with a new step every day. Build a stairway to paradise with a new step every day. I'm gonna get there at any price. Stand aside, I'm on my way. I got the blues, head up above it, so fair shoes. Come on and carry me there. I'll build a stairway to paradise every day with a new step every day. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. There is so much more that I could tell you about the Gershwins, but I want to leave a little time to take questions, because that way maybe I'll answer some of the things that you might want to know about the Gershwins. I ask that you, if you raise your hand, someone with a microphone will approach you so everyone will be able to hear you. So queries of any sort are encouraged. Anybody? Yes, please.
What was the origin of Tin Pan Alley, and how did it get its name?
Tin Pan Alley. Supposedly, Tin Pan Alley was a phrase coined by a man who was a songwriter and a newspaper reporter named Monroe Rosenfeld. He was writing an article about the row of publishing houses that were all gathered together. I think it was on 28th Street at that time, between 5th and Broadway. And that street was a cacophony of sounds, because every publishing house had guys that played the piano to exploit the songs, and the windows were open because it's pre-air conditioning. And so there was this sound that just went into the streets, this noise that he described as sounding like tin pans banging together, and called it Tin Pan Alley. And that's where the name came from. Yes. We have no bananas.
I recall hearing you when you were in your 20s or early 30s at the start of your career, and at that time you appeared to me to be a brilliant pianist, an impeccable stylist, but with a voice that wasn't a particularly strong musical instrument. Since that time, your voice seems to have become much stronger. How did that happen?
Well, actually, I think it's your hearing. Do you hear as well as you did 20 years ago? The truth is that, now that I've had fun at your expense, I apologize. The truth is that it's all been a progression of working and performing and evolving. So I have no magic bullet or credit I can give to anyone. It's just been an evolution of performing a lot over these many years, and I think getting deeper into the songs and becoming perhaps a better singer in the process. But thank you for acknowledging that. Anyway, yes, ma'am.
The recent production of Porgy and Bess on Broadway was rather controversial. I'm wondering how Gershwin would feel about it, do you think?
And how you want me to channel Gershwin?
Channel, as you have been, and how you felt about it.
The idea of this new Broadway version of Porgy and Bess, was to create a version that would be completely separate from the opera, to create something that would repeat the success that Porgy and Bess had on Broadway in 1942. When Porgy and Bess premiered, it was a failure, and it was a full opera sung all the way through, very little, almost no dialogue. Its first success, Porgy and Bess first had any sort of popular success in 1942 when it was produced on Broadway as a musical. They took out all the recitative. It was a show with a book and with songs. And the idea currently was to create a new version of Porgy and Bess that would live alongside the opera. The opera being what it is, and the Gershwin family's reasoning that a certain number of people would go to see an opera and many people would never go to an opera. So they tried to create something that was a separate entity. What happened is that during the preparation and production of that show, this version, there were a lot of problems that beset them, and they eventually started going back and putting the recitative back into the opera, and it became a neither fish nor fowl sort of thing. So it did not fulfill the original idea of what it was supposed to be, and I think in many instances it ended up displeasing both, because people who love the opera were offended that it was sort of opera light, and people who love Broadway didn't want to hear the recitative. So I think that it was a noble but misguided attempt. Yes.
This is not Gershwin related, but the wonderful, clever lyrics that are sung at the beginning of many popular songs that many popular artists don't sing, the lead-in thing, does that have a term? Is that called something? And that is?
Yes. It's called the verse. Sometimes it's called the introduction. In music today, the term verse is used differently. There's verse, chorus, verse, chorus, verse, chorus. But previously, when the Gershwins wrote, like, "You heard someone to watch over me," there's a saying old, that's called the verse. That's usually 16 bars in length, sometimes a little longer, and then you get to the chorus. Ira Gershwin and other songwriters I met told me that they worked just as hard on the verses as they did on the choruses, and often felt thwarted when they didn't hear the verses. One of the greatest verses I like better than the chorus is Stardust. And Frank Sinatra actually made a recording of just the verse of Stardust without the chorus to show how extraordinary a verse can be. So the verse is yet to come. Sorry. But it is something that is... That's why I'm not in the Catskills tonight. So, yes. So... It's called the verse. Sir.
Thank you.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you? So good to see you.
You too.
First of all, thank you for devoting an entire career to the preservation of the Great American Songbook.
You're welcome.
I have great...
Thank you. Thank you.
Of course, my fear is for the future of the Great American Songbook, demographically and looking at music today. And I'm just curious as... from your point of view, where you see it, how you see it being preserved, and how that's going to happen, if it's going to live on the way we all want to see it live on.
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, do you know Eddie Bruce, who is a marvelous... Stand, so say hello to... he is doing as much as anybody to keep this music alive. So thank you for that. It is a group effort. The songs only survive because people care about them, they want to hear them, they pass them on from one to another. I think that the music will survive. I don't think it's ever going to be mainstream again. It's possible, I suppose, but I think that it will live because of technology today. YouTube, of all the things that exist that make it possible for young people to discover the music, they're discovering it. They're never going to be on a show like American Idol, but they are out there, and I created the Feinstein Initiative. There are many organizations that exist to nurture young people in it. And the Feinstein Initiative, we have a yearly high school competition where kids apply from all over the country to sing the Great American Songbook. So the bottom line is that it comes with educating people. We have to get back to arts education, period, where we now have had several generations. It's an extraordinary time because for some reason arts have been devalued where politicians no longer realize that arts are as important as anything else that one can learn in their life journey. I believe that the reason we have such an extraordinary political divide today is because we have lost the common ground that arts give us. The thing that brings us together are the arts, and we have lost that, so we must get back to that. And I believe that we will get back to that. I don't know when that will happen in a larger sense, but that will happen because a society cannot survive without a very important place for the arts. And so as we continue to disintegrate, at some point enough people are going to realize that this is one of the problems that needs to be fixed, that we will start moving in the other direction. So, thank you. Yes.
Michael, when I noodle around on the piano, I noticed that someone to watch over me, the man I love, is always in E-flat. Were they the original keys that George wrote them in, or have they been transposed over the years?
In the case of the man I love, that was the original key that it was written in. Someone to watch over me, I'm not certain. Keeping in mind that both of those songs were created for women to sing, and those are not ladies' keys. Often, sheet music is published for whatever reason in keys that men sing in. They're the male keys, C and E flat. And I'm not certain why that is, nor do I understand why George would have composed The Man I Love in E flat, knowing that it was going to be transposed to another key. So when you say originally, when Gertrude Lawrence introduced Someone to Watch Over Me, she did not sing it in E-flat. She probably sang it in, I have to listen to her two recordings of it, probably sang it in B-flat or maybe A, somewhere around there. So it varies. It varies from song to song. Sometimes the publishers would change the keys of the songs because they wanted to make it simpler for people to perform. And quite often, in preparing sheet music, they would simplify it with the approval of the composers, but the composers often did so with regret, knowing that it needed to be simplified, but also knowing that some of the essence of what they wrote was being left out. Yes. You, with the questioning.
Mike. actually had two questions. If you have a special friendship with Stephen Sondheim, considering his relationship with Oscar Hammerstein. And I also wonder how Rhapsody in Blue was a flawed movie, in what way?
Okay. Rhapsody in Blue was a flawed movie because they had trouble creating conflict in George Gershwin's life, because the only tragic thing that happened to him was his untimely death. But prior to that, it was success most of the way. I mean, Porgy and Bess, there were bumps in the road. So they contrived a whole story that was fictitious. I mean, all the events were moved around and changed for dramatic license, and that's why it was changed around. I am friendly with Stephen Sondheim. He is an extraordinary guy. I don't agree with his opinions often because in his book of writings about lyrics and the craft of lyric writing, he is particularly devastating to Ira Gershwin, whom he refers to as rhyming poison. He has very specific opinions that sometimes I think are wacky, but he's a genius and he's entitled to them. One night I was singing My Romance, the great Rodgers and Hart song, and he came backstage and said, "I hate that song." I said, "How can you hate that song? It's a great song." I said, it's gorgeous. He said, "Yeah, the music's gorgeous, but that lyric." I said, "What's wrong with the lyric?" He said, "That line, my romance doesn't need a castle rising in Spain nor a dance to a constantly surprising refrain." I said, "What's wrong with that?" He said, "I've never danced to a constantly surprising refrain, and neither have you." And I said, "Some of your refrains are constantly surprising." You know, he writes very surprising refrains. So there we are. Yes.
I had the privilege of hearing you, I think, when you first hit the scene. And I remember...
Well, I'm glad you consider that a privilege. Thank you.
It was.
Thank you.
And I was smart enough, as untutored as I am, to recognize your multiple talents. But I don't know if I remember correctly that at the time that I first heard you, I thought, what a talent. But he's singing, you were doing Frank Sinatra.
No.
Well, at the time heard you, you were so much like him, I thought, how is he going to ever distinguish himself? So maybe you didn't recognize it, but I recognize it.
You're the only person who has ever said that. In 40 years of performing,
That'll fix me for asking questions.
No, it just is interesting because people often said that I sounded like Johnny Mathis, but nobody ever compared me to Sinatra because I was a crooner, and I didn't really have a lot of affection for the way Sinatra sang the songs. I grew into that later to appreciate that he would take the songs and do swing versions of them, but my early career at solo piano was the antithesis of what Frank Sinatra did.
But you had the style. From the beginning.
I had the style. Let's leave it at that.
You had style.
Sir, in the middle of this, if we can get a microphone to you, or if you have lusty lungs, here we go.
Looking at Broadway during the last decade or so.
Must I?
Well, that was going to be my question. I wondered who among the composers and lyricist teams do you favor, if any?
There are many talented people. Adam Gettle is very talented, perhaps a little too sophisticated for the general public. As sometimes happens. John Buchino is a great songwriter. Amanda Green is a great lyricist. The guy who wrote the score, Larry Yazbek, I think is great. I think there's some very talented people out there. I think the problem for me for Broadway is that the synthesis of book, of the totality of it. Like I went to see a show the other night, which is a new musical that was very entertaining, but it had a wafer-thin plot, and it was very disappointing for me. Like the show Once, which is so highly acclaimed. For me, that was a show that has songs that were very ordinary, and the big mistake for me in that show, or the big loss, I should say, is that those are not songs that really move the plot along. When Alan J. Lerner wrote My Fair Lady, he talked about how every single song had to be a moment that when you burst into song, that takes you from here to here, plot-wise, and it's something that emotionally can only happen in the context of that song. By the end of that song, you are taken to another place, you're in another strata, and you understand more about the character, and it's magic. I so rarely have that experience now. A show like Billy Elliot, which was a show that succeeded, brilliant show, succeeded in spite of the songs. That was a score that every time there was a musical number, I felt the audience kind of go like this, and then they got them back. It was unbelievable. And the thing that I most long for is that craft. But there are talented people, and I do not lose hope for Broadway because there are always new people coming along. And I think it can still happen. It's just that the public, the producers believe that the public is dumbed down, where they do jukebox musicals and they do things that they think are safe in a way that makes it harder to get something innovative on Broadway. But it will continue, and someone's going to come along, or some others will come along who will get a break, and it'll happen. I believe firmly in that. I'm a cockeyed optimist. Sir. Wait for the mic.
How much of the Gershwin music is based in the Jewish and Yiddish themes and religious songs?
How much of the music? Very little. George Gershwin and Ira were not religious at all, and Ira very specifically told me that he had a nodding acquaintance with Yiddish theater, but didn't really know much of it at all. George knew Yiddish theater a little better because when he was a song plugger, the publishers would send him down there, and he would meet and see the shows. He knew Sholem Secunda and Rum Shimsky and some of the other writers of Yiddish theater. But since his passing, much has been made of certain chants and cantorial things that he's supposed to have based some of his pieces on, and it is simply not true. It is not true. He was no more influenced by Jewish music than he was by all the other kinds of ethnic music and all the other sounds that he heard. Even though when Cole Porter came to George Gershwin having a period of non-success, he said, "What am I doing wrong?" And George said, "You have to write good Jewish music." And what he meant was he told him to write music that had a folk quality to it. And Porter went on to write the most Jewish-sounding music. I mean, my heart belongs to Daddy, because I simply couldn't be bad. Yes, my heart belongs to Daddy. You know, so there you go.
Michael, we can take one more.
One more question. So we need one more great question to end, to conclude on. Who has a great question? Do you have a great question? No, she shook her head no. No. Okay. It's still, we're happy to take your question. I bet it's going to be great.
You'll decide. It's a two-parter.
Two-parter. Okay.
One is, what's your favorite Gershwin piece to play?
Right.
And your Desert Island Gershwin piece.
Okay.
And are they the same or different?
Okay. My favorite Gershwin song to play is "Isn't It a Pity," which I adore. Desert Island Gershwin would probably be his own recordings. No, I take that back. Johnny Green did a series of recordings with Fred Astaire, who is my favorite singer, in 1936 of the songs from Shall We Dance? And those performances of those songs are my absolute favorite performances of Gershwin songs, of those six songs he recorded. They Can't Take That Away From Me, They All Laughed, Let's Call the Whole Thing Off, Slap That Bass, Beginner's Luck, and whatever the sixth one is. Those would be Desert Island recordings. If I was, if it was a piece of music of Gershwin's, I would probably say the Concerto in F, because I could be endlessly fascinated by discovering what's in there. Stephen Sondheim, not incidentally, is Porgy and Bess. Of any music in the world, including his own, he said that his Desert Island music would be Porgy and Bess. Thank you so much, everybody. This has been fantastic.
Where am I going?
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.